the church distinguishes between the work of teaching and preaching. Maybe you don't think of it this way, but this is the way seminarians are trained. They spend a long time learning, getting instruction, but then they're told, don't do that when you're preaching, because a lot of theology or a lot of philosophy, a lot of head knowledge is not what people need in order to live the Christian life. They need some instruction, but they need inspiration. Well, with that in mind, I have to caution, because I have to give a little bit of instruction here. We could jump right into the readings. They have this great reading from Genesis about the beginning of creation, very profound reading. And then we have the story about Jesus, who's like the Creator, who brings into the world this extraordinary power of healing that even the tassel on his cloak heals everybody who touches it. So that's a lot. But before we get into the readings, let's just look at how the liturgy is structured. We start at ordinary time, at least looking at how the daily Mass readings are structured. We have been, from the beginning of ordinary time up until Saturday, been reading from the letter to the Hebrews, that great theological work in the New Testament. But now, starting with the fifth week, and for the next 2 weeks, we're going to be taking our first reading from the book of Genesis, from the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis, which is the prehistory of the Bible. Great, great stories with extraordinary lessons for us. And so that's what we'll be doing almost until Ash Wednesday, almost until the beginning of Lent. Now, when it comes to the story of creation, it's impossible to measure the impact that this story of creation has had on at least Western civilization, if not the whole world, but especially Western civilization. It gives a framework for understanding everything. And there are volumes, there's libraries of commentaries on the stories of creation. Now, we learned this story as children. God made the world in 7 days. He worked for 6 days and he rested 1 day. The reading we just heard this morning is the first 4 days. With the arrival of the Enlightenment or the scientific age, an argument arose in Western culture that went something like this. Well, that story in the Bible worked for an era when people were not thinking scientifically. It's a very useful myth. But now that we understand science, we don't need that story anymore, because we know that the earth was not created in 6 days. It evolved through geologic ages, and plants and animals evolved over millions of years. So there's no reason to talk about 6 days when you're talking about 300 million years or something like that. Or if you go back to the beginning of the stars, it's back in the billions of years. And that's the way scientists talk. And for a while, Christians were saying, well, we can't just throw out the Bible, so therefore we'll throw out the science. Well, that doesn't work, because you can't throw out science. It's true. What we can prove empirically is true. But it doesn't mean that the Bible is not true. It means we're talking about two different levels. And this is what wise Christians came up with pretty quickly. In fact, even way back in the fathers of the church, read St. Augustine, for example. He didn't think we were talking about 6 literal days. He knew it was talking about a process by which God ordered creation. But anyway, in the scientific age, we have to acknowledge what we know scientifically, what we know by reason and investigation, and at the same time acknowledge that there are some things that science cannot explain. And it is beyond the capacity. Some things are beyond the capacity of reason and science, including why is there anything at all? And why is it like this? Science tells us what is, and the correspondence of one thing to another. We can measure distance, time, weight. We can discover laws that order things, but we can't say why those laws exist. We can't even say why anything exists by science, because it doesn't answer that question. That's more philosophical or religious question. Well, let's go to this. Aware that we're not talking about fiction here, we're talking about truth, not scientific truth. We're talking about deeper truth, or higher truth, I don't know how you say it, something that is that goes outside the very specific boundaries that science has to work within. We're talking about things that cannot be examined, measured, weighed, reasoned. Now, you know that scientists are always trying to figure out how the universe got to be like this, and so they go back to the Big Bang. The Big Bang. That's as far as they can go, because if you try to go before the Big Bang, there's no evidence. So there's no scientific research into what's before everything that we know existed. So there's always that limit. But they look into the heavens, and they say, okay, well, I see that little point of light out there. That's a galaxy. It's about 200 million light years away. So that means it existed 200 million years ago, and we're just seeing the light arriving now. Beautiful. But that's not what Genesis is talking about. This is talking about, gosh, I don't even know where to start, because this is so different, a way of thinking, that it's unique in world literature. It's unique in the presentation of what is. You see, every culture, every religion has some kind of description of its origins, because we don't know who we are unless we know our origins. We don't know how we're supposed to live unless we have some understanding of why we are the way we are. So these creation stories are very important in every culture. And in every culture, except for the Jews, the creation stories are descriptions of tension, of violence, sea monsters and cloud monsters and mountain gods, and they fight each other and they divide each other up, and they romance each other, or they seduce each other, or they manipulate each other into different liaisons, and then different fruits come from their interactions. And that's how most creation stories are. And you think of the gods of the different ancient civilizations, there are lots of gods, and they don't get along. The sea god and the land god, they don't get along. And the question is, well, who's in the battle between the sea and the land, who's going to win? Well, it depends on who's got the stronger monsters, or who's got the bigger weapons. And primitive peoples, I shouldn't maybe use that term, but ancient peoples, they understood that if the sea god got angry, well, then you had a big storm and big waves came and knocked over all your houses, or the god of war overcame the god of love, and so everything got wiped out. But then if you make a sacrifice to the god of love, and then the god of love will make your plants grow and you'll have a fruitful harvest. That's how it worked. But there's this tension, this conflict, this rivalry, this love-hate situation all the time. And that perception of reality is how, that's why people acted the way they did, because you can't make powerful forces angry at you. You have to submit to them. Don't step on the toes of the sea monster. If you're going to go out on a ship, you make a sacrifice to the gods of the sea before you go out on a ship. If you're going to build something, you make a sacrifice to the land god, or the mountain god, or the earth god, so that you're not hurting anybody's feelings, who's going to smash you with a bolt of lightning, something like that. Now, that's how people kind of conceive reality. Then the scientists, modern scientists, say, well, of course, that's a lot of garbage. I mean, there's no sea monsters. They're just whales and sharks and stuff. And there's no god. There's no, these mythical beings don't exist. What there is there's gravity, there's nuclear force, strong force, weak force, and, there's chemical bonds and all this stuff. And so everything happening merely as a result of natural forces that exist. Random and explainable insofar as we understand the laws. Then there's Genesis. Then there's this story in which there is someone who is not part of creation. There's this wasteland, there's darkness, there's a formless chaos. And then there's this someone, God, this voice, and he says, let there be light. And there was light. He's not overcoming anybody. He's not fighting anybody. He's not taking anyone's territory. He's not anyone's rival. He's above the whole thing. He's all powerful. Now, you know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but knowing this changes how we perceive reality, that there is someone who is above all this. We don't have to fight him. We don't have to manipulate him. We don't have to seduce him. We don't have to run away from him. He's not part of the game. He just says, this is how it's going to be, and it is. And there's no one else like that. There's God and there's everything else. There's God the creator and there's creation. That's all. That explains everything. There's no darkness God and light God. There's just God. And he made both darkness and light. And it's good. He made light. He said, oh, this is good. He separated light from darkness. Day, night. This is how it's going to be. Day, night. This is beyond our capacity. We don't make day and night. It's a given. Let's separate the sky from the earth and the sea. Let's separate, you know, land and sea. Let's decorate this house with some lights. It's not anything like anyone else's perception of creation. It's something like an architect designing and building a house. I'm going to put a big picture window here because it faces the south and I want to get a view. And the architect decides how it's going to be. And then he says, the house doesn't say, I don't want it like that. The house doesn't have any say. Or you might say it's something like a playwright, you know, Shakespeare. Shakespeare says, I'm going to put Juliet up on the balcony, I'm going to put Romeo down here. And that's just the way it's going to be. Juliet's up on the balcony saying, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? She doesn't turn to Shakespeare and say, well, why don't you give him a different name, because then we won't have a rivalry between our families. She can't do that. She's not on that level. She doesn't even know Shakespeare. No, it's not an exact analogy, of course, because we can know there's a God, but we can't address him as if we can tell him anything that is not already in his hands. So God is all powerful. God brings order out of chaos. He's an orderly God. He establishes the order of creation, and that's why creation is ordered, and that's why we can have science. Imagine if it wasn't ordered. Imagine if God was not a God of order. We wouldn't know if the sun would come up or not. You couldn't have science because there would be no laws to follow. The sun comes up when it wants to. Well, then there's no such thing as day and night. It's just chaos again. And if there's chaos, there's no science. He's a powerful God, he's an orderly God, and he's a good God. What he makes is good. This is really really important. What God makes is good. We're the recipients of a good, ordered creation. What is good. What is, as God made it to be, is good. I'm sure all of you have suffered the water shortage these last couple of weeks. Every day there's no water. Well, And the first few days of that, you could hear me complaining every day if you want, but the first few days of that, I said, what is this? How come there's no water again? And, you know, all day long, no water, and then late in the afternoon it would come on. I don't know about your houses, but that's how it's been here. And after a few, you know, the first few days, it's really distressing because you use up all your water and can't flush the toilet. That's distressing. But after a few days, I learned the pattern. Well, late afternoon, the water comes on. It's on for a few hours. And then you fill up all your buckets, and then the water goes off, and that's the way it is. If that's the way it is, if it's ordered, I can adjust to that. I don't complain about that anymore because I know how it's going to work. But as soon as the water doesn't come on at 4 p.m. or whatever this, whoever's deciding this, well, then I'm upset again. But, you know, I can adjust. We can adjust. You know, we don't have to flee our homes like some parts of the world where people have to leave in order to survive. There's nothing really that much to complain about. But what we can't do is say, let there be water. We don't even think of it. We don't have that kind of power, let there be water. And we shouldn't put in our minds that we can do that about anything in reality, that we can take that kind of charge. Because once we do that, we're really interfering with what is, and we're rivaling God, and that's disastrous for us. The modern way of thinking, the postmodern way of thinking, rivals God. It claims, that mentality claims to be able to say, let there be something, and it is. And that's God's business. That's revealed here. And no creature has that power. Okay, I probably go on and on about this, but it's really, really important to know who's God and how we relate to Him as a good God, a powerful God, an ordered God, and how everything in our life is so dependent on Him, and we can be grateful for everything that is. Now, let's just take a brief look at Jesus, who comes into the territory that He has created as a creature among His creatures. Yesterday, we reflected on His saying, you are the salt of the earth, you're the light of the world. Well, how can He say that? Well, because He created salt. It's right here, third day, or whatever it is, fourth day, third day. Yeah, they brought forth the earth, all the salt. How can He say, you're the light of the world? Because He's the one who says, let there be light. He has authority to say, what's light? In fact, when He created light in the beginning, He already had in His mind that He was going to come into the world Himself and say, I'm the light of the world. And He already had in His mind that His disciples were going to be the light of the world. So when He created light, He had all this in mind. We're just opening ourselves to what He has in mind for all eternity. Here He is, comes into the Gennesaret region, the other side of the sea. People realize that this is not an ordinary preacher. This is a source of divine power. They might not have thought He was God, but they knew God was at work through Him, even the tassel of His cloak. This is Jesus. This is how we know Him. He's a contact point with God. Well, I'll go on too long here, but you know, when people started getting gadgets, when I used to fly in airports, you know, people didn't have gadgets. You didn't have to worry about charging. Everybody just watched the movie on the plane. That was it. But once people started getting gadgets, then they had to have chargers and rechargers. And the airports weren't ready for that. There were only a few outlets. And so people would go to the outlets and the airports and like fight over the power sources. And then the airport started putting in these power stations. And crowds of people would just gather around the power station to power up their phones and their tablets. But that's something like Jesus. When you have a source of power, you go there and you touch it. You plug into it so that you can be recharged. That's who Jesus is for us. And more, of course. But let's accept what He reveals of Himself. Accept the reality, the good, ordered reality that He presents to us. We are recipients of what is good. We don't understand it all. We don't know why it's the way it is, but we accept. God creator, God lover, God father, God source of life and of healing. Thanks be to God.